Thank you, Amit, for joining me. I'd love to start by asking the same question that we do with all our guests, which is, who was the first person to make you feel like you had talent?
Like advertising wise, I'd probably say.
No, yeah.
My mother and my father. It could be, I guess. But advertising wise, Cam Blackley, for sure. I had just won Young Guns Creative Brief, and I didn't know what I wanted to do. I didn't know where I was going to work. I was working at a mutual funds company as an assistant because I got fired from my first ad job. And
I don't know about that.
Yeah. But the way it works is a Young Guns Creative Brief, when I did it, it was the first time they opened up to students to come up with a campaign to get people to submit awards or sorry, entries. But the years before that, they would, you know, talk to agencies and they would do a pro bono to do something kind of fun and crazy and wacky. The year prior to us doing it and winning it, Droga, Sydney had done it. So anyways, I didn't know what to do. I got hit up by JWT Melbourne. That wasn't a great shop at the time. I don't know if it's still around. And the ego that I had was like, no, no, no. I want to go work somewhere great. But I didn't feel I could cut it in New York. So I did my top five agencies like Colenso and stuff. And Droga 5 Sydney was one of them. And I emailed Cam and Maddie directly, Maddie Byrne. And I was like, hey, like you guys did Young Guns last year, I did it this year, mine's better, hire me, essentially.
Where did that confidence come from?
I have no idea. It's been like both a gift and a curse. But within 6 hours, he was like, done. You know, we'll talk to our people, but we're gonna meet an art director who was my first partner, rest in peace, Marcus Johnston, who I love and miss dearly, but you're gonna meet him, Baldrick, they called him. But just that like volition, I was so quick at looking my book and bringing me over. And it was such a great experience because it was like 6 months. I actually didn't end up getting retained for a variety of visa reasons. But when the decision was made that they weren't gonna renew my visa, which was Cam's boss decision at the time, Cam was so angry about it. And I think that anger made me feel like I had something. I was like, this guy's pretty fucking pissed off that I'm not getting kept.
Yeah.
And we done some really good work and I kind of worked my ass off. And that was when I was like, okay, cool. I can kind of do something with this. But yeah, it definitely Cam.
So where were you before the Young Guns then? Before you applied? How did you even get into this world in the first place?
Well, I didn't know advertising was a thing. I was in college, a university. I didn't know what I was going to do. It's a classic like immigrant story. I was like, I'm going to be a lawyer. Like you tell your parents, like you could be a doctor, lawyer, engineer. Yeah. Those are the three immigrant pathways. There's no other pathways that your parents are like, cool. So I told my parents I was going to be a lawyer forever. And I had no shot at being a lawyer. I think I did pre-law, like one class, and I got like a 60%.
I think you're quite articulate. I think you made a good...
Yeah, I'm good at making bullshit up. But I was like in a basement eating pizza and watching TV, and this like show came on. I don't know why to this day. And it was just these like, it was like Lee Clow types, like on in Boats and Con wearing white linen. And they're like, you know, when we came up with the Budweiser Was Up ad. And I was like, holy shit, like that people, that's a creative endeavor. I had my own magazine, a literary journal I was doing. I was a little bit creative here and there, but not fully confident. But long story short, I kind of looked into it, went to ad school, got hired at this small little agency. I don't know if it's even open anymore, called Smith Roberts.
Where were you at the time?
In Toronto.
In Toronto.
And like, within 6 months, and after that I got fired because I was like, I was kind of like, you guys are very safe. And it was a very small shop. But now I understand the business. I get why. Like, it didn't have interesting clients for the most part. They couldn't really take big creative risks. And I was just hard-headed and I wanted to do cool shit. And I had a big attitude. So they fired me. And then I like happened to go to like a production house party. And I met one of my friends, ended up kind of meeting a girl. They started talking and then she happened to live. She's an ACD at a really good shop, John Street. Yep. So she invited me to a party. I met an art director and he's like, let's do Young Guns together. And that's kind of, it was all very serendipitous, sliding doors type shit.
Nice. Okay, cool. So going back to Droga, getting whatever happened with the visa, then what happened after that? You come back to Toronto?
No, I was like, didn't know what to do. And they had hired a freelancer at Droga to work on a pitch with me, who's much older, named Andrew Ostrom, who does some fantastic work, still lives in Sydney, very lovely human. And I just ran into him at a Vice party, an art exhibit. And I was like, yeah, they're not keeping me. Like, it's kind of crazy. He's like, what the fuck? Like, come over to, he's at Ogilvy, come tomorrow. And I'll have you meet the ECD, who is Chris Ford. Mm. And within like a few days, they hired me. And that's, I worked at Ogilvy Sydney, and that's where I got like the Share a Coke brief. I got to work with like really talented people and do that big thing. And then that kind of like steamrolled the whole process of jumping around. And
how did all of that come around? Because the next question I was going to ask is about the work that made you. And I feel like that was quite a significant part.
So that work is Chris Ford. It's mostly Chris Ford, to be honest. I mean, he had the concept of it, but it was really kind of interesting and crazy about it. It was like, it hadn't been sold in yet. I was brought in to like kind of help build the campaign, build the work. And it was an ECD, an ACD team, and then me. and then a partner of mine, Luke Ackert, who's my son's godfather now, but so that was kind of layered. But within like the first like month of us trying to get the work sold in, building the case study, thinking of the out-of-home stuff, and like building all the elements of it, and even getting the idea off the ground, Chris left, the senior team left, and it was just me. And there was a creative director named Boris who was super hands-off, very lovely, but super hands-off. And we were just left to our own devices.
Wow.
To this giant campaign with like product packaging, film, out of home, like all the different elements. And I honestly think the only reason why we were able to do that, all the work, was because it was in Australia before social media really existed. Mm. So they were kind of like, because it's such a huge risk for them, like if you fuck it up, no one's going to hear about it because it's all the way in Australia.
Yeah.
But it blew up. And then
so is it just regional or national for Australia? And
it was, yeah, exactly. And then they're like, holy shit, it's gangbusters. And then they're like, okay, cool, let's keep spreading it. But it's taken a lot of life forms of its own. But to me the best thing still to this day is the thing that we did, which was we changed the Coke sign in Sydney, which is iconic, and you could like text your name and it would project it over.
Wow.
And you can have like Share a Coke with Sam, Share a Coke with whoever. And that was a huge endeavor. But I was like, you know, kind of the first time you text something and see something happen in the real world. And I think that's still the best pure expression of the idea to this day with all the different articulations of it.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was like a same thing, sliding doors, collaboration, and just kind of being, it's unfortunate that the people left above me, but being super lucky to run the shit by myself as a junior.
Yeah, that's really cool. Cool. I want to know now, where do you go from there? That feels like, and you must have won every single award under the sun.
We didn't win it. This crazy thing is like, in today's day and age, you see books and they're like, I did like whatever campaign, it's like 15 lines. We got a gold, a couple silvers, a couple bronze, and a creative effectiveness. It's not a huge fucking like haul.
Oh, right.
You know what I mean? Because it wasn't that many categories.
They just more awards now?
I think there's more awards, more categories. I think back then we were probably a lot more like harder on what wins.
Yeah. Can you resubmit awards?
Yeah. And I also like, I don't think anyone, I mean, even when we were working on it and people like, what are you working on? I was like, name tags on a bottle. Like I didn't understand the magnitude. I don't think anyone understood what was kind of sitting in front of us. I think the year that we submitted Dumb Ways to Die picked up everything. I can't remember. But with that said, after that, even before the award shows came around, we went to DDB Sydney because Ogilvy Sydney, it was great for that time in my life, but it wasn't a great shop. And we just kind of wanted to bounce around, try some new things. But we went to DDB Sydney, which we did some interesting things. I think we did a couple of small things that picked up some more awards. But I'll be pretty honest, that was like the heyday of me having a giant ego and being a kind of a fuckwit, to be honest. I was partying a lot because I never had partied a lot growing up. I was just like out and about Australia, like late 20s, like figuring out who I am as a person. And now that I think about it, like I was not the most professional. And
so they put up with you.
They put up with me and my partner, Luke Akrit, the saint that he is, like just dealt with it all. He was he's always like so professional, so on top of things. And I was just like, what about this, Ren? And it was just, it's a really funny time. But it's also like, it felt to me the last bit of advertising of what it once was.
Okay, that's a good point. That's interesting.
Just kind of like hedonistic. It was like a work hard, play hard mentality, which I think has kind of been stripped away, unfortunately.
Interesting. We'll get onto all of that, I think, yeah. So when did you come back to North America?
2 years at DDB, or year, 2 years at Fish, and then we went to Pereira and SF for two-ish years, which was okay. It was a bit of a bust, to be honest. It was good for my own personal life, but I didn't love my time there. The agency just wasn't the right fit. And I think that's like a really interesting thing is like, agencies can be the right, it's like a sports team. There's a right playbook and right, you know, soccer, right system, right?
Yeah, yeah.
You might not be good for a 4-4-2. You might want to do a, 5-4-1.
That's so interesting.
Like it just doesn't fit, which is fine. But yeah, it just wasn't, the people there, some really lovely people, some other people I just didn't mesh with. From a personality perspective, from a creative perspective, just have very different opinions. The type of work that we want to make and do just wasn't in line with the vision they had at that office. And once again, they've done some great work. So it's one of those things.
Could you have known that if you'd known the right questions to ask in the interview? Or you knew that that was the place that you wanted to go to, do you think?
No, we interviewed a bunch of places and we had offers from a bunch of places across New York and SF. I think they just kind of, it's like anything, they give you they sell you on something and you buy into it, but you can't ask questions. I think, I wish I had done a little more, I wish two things. I mean, one, I wish I knew the type of work I really wanted to make. At the time, I think I was a little bit ambiguous. I was like, I can do funny. I want to do more funny stuff.
Yeah.
I'm just not a funny writer. I suck at it, to be honest. It's not my forte. It was Jamie Robinson, who was very different, now runs Jonas. She's super lovely, and but we didn't get to work together with her too much, but it was Rob Lambricks and Jason Apolinski. I love Jason. But Rob and I were just very different creatively, and I just didn't enjoy. The review process wasn't great, and if I had probably dove more into the type of, if I knew those would be my most day-to-days, if I dove deeper, and I think there's a big tip for younger audience, like younger talent, like dive deep into the work. It's like a reel for a director.
Yeah.
You know, 90% is the real, 10% is the treatment, right? So 90% is their book and 10% is the sell job they give you, the vision they give you. But ultimately, you're going to end up doing the type of work that this person is really putting in front of you.
True.
Or they're putting out the world. And that was just not the right fit. But I met my wife in SF, so that kind of worked out.
Yep, totally.
And after that, I was going to quit advertising. That's how much I hated it.
Wow. Just from that place, or
it really bummed me out. I was really depressed, and I was gonna quit. And then the day I decided, I was like, I'm gonna go back to school. I think out of the blue, a recruiter hit me up about JL. All
right,
and we had interviewed with JL before we took the Pereira job. It was like really random. In Cannes, we just met briefly with Yana Leo. I was quite drunk, so I don't think they remember it. But when I was going to go do an interview at Wieden in New York, or it might have been Greg, I can't remember, I hailed a yellow cab stopped. I swear to God, a yellow cab stopped in like Chelsea or Soho. And as I was about, as the person was getting out of it, but going, it was Leo. And I was like, that's fucking weird. And he's been someone whose work I loved, and Jan's too. Like I always like. And anyways, so we just kind of chatted. Hey, so weird, blah blah, blah, and then a couple years go by, and the day, it was October 17th, I think, or like a couple days before that, but it was around my birthday. The day I was like, all right, I'm gonna quit the game. I got hit up by a recruiter like, hey Jay, I want to talk to you. I did an interview with them, and they're incredibly tough in interviews, and they take forever to make a decision. And within a day, I had an offer. 2 days, I had an offer. And I was like, great. And they did the type of work I wanted to do. And it was like five really great, years of like ups and downs and learning experiences, and doing some cool shit that I really to this day hold very dear to my heart.
Yeah, it's a remarkable agency. But just going back a step, is that when you split from your partner?
Yeah, we made the mistake of
when is that moment? Do you think with the team?
Ours is really so. Luke and I, he's like a husband to me, basically a brother. He's like a brother to me. But like him and I met. And we kind of grew up advertising together, but we had the same friends, we did the same party cycle when, a lot of things were very kind of tied, and we moved to SF, we ended up getting a place together, which was great for most of it. But like when the work thing wasn't working out, like when Pereira wasn't really going the way we wanted it to, there was some levels of animosity coming out of it. And frustration. And it's not like, like when you're a married couple, you might be frustrated, but you can, fuck it up.
Yeah.
you're married. You get it. Yeah. Like you can, like, there's ways to like ease the tension.
Yeah.
Right. Whatever. Go on dates, do your thing, whatever you may be into. Fuck it. But, banging. But we couldn't do that. So like, it was sitting and it was just like time for a change. I didn't handle that. Probably the best way I could have. I was kind of like, I'm out. But yeah, we split, and probably for a good year, like we didn't really chat. And then one of our friends got married in Scotland, and we met, and we're like, oh yeah, like we are honestly the best mates.
Good. Okay. Cool.
But yeah, I think
So,
but going back to the purpose of your question, really, as opposed to just my own personal act.
No.
it is. You kind of like so. The relationship thing is really important, right? Like I think Ian Merlin, who's this great creative in Canada back in the day, did a lot of like Levi's work. Mm. He was like, it's as tough as a marriage because you only get one or two good partners in your career. I've had more bad partners than good partners, to be honest. And this is not like an attack to them in any shape or form. It just wasn't the right fit. I'm also like not an easy person to work with. I have very strong opinions. I'm a little hard-headed. I get it. The reason why it's really important to have a great partner is that you go into a creative review putting your best foot forward. You're aligned on that vision. Like, this is our shit. Yeah. This work is us.
Yeah.
So if they don't like it, because we work in a subjective field, like there is no bad, you're not like, oh, if only that person pushed it. You know what I mean? If only that person showed up more, if only they liked my idea more. So it removes that. So that's when you have a good partnership. But ultimately, I think it ends with age. I don't think people stay partners some people do, but like as you kind of grow up the corporate ladder, like it's hard to stay as a team. Mm. I have a co-CC now. I love him deaf. He's amazing. I think for the most part, it just kind of evolves over time. And
it gets to that point though, like ECD level gets to that point where you're kind of like, well, you can nearly divide and conquer sometimes.
Yeah, and then like life comes at it. You're like, hey, this place is offering me a CCO game, but they only want one person. It's more money and more, it's more ambitious and it's more something else. Or I'm moving somewhere else. Like, I'm growing a family. Like those things come. But the first 10 years of your career, like if you can find that one partner that you're just doing great work with and that you have like respect and you can just sit in a room for hours, and it's chatting shit about the work or just not saying anything at all and be comfortable.
Yeah. No, that's cool. Wow. Okay. So let's go from JL. No, let's go from JL. You went to Fig. Then you went to, no, have I missed one out?
Yeah.
No,
JL and Fig.
JL, Fig. A lot of independent agencies. Is that a theme with you?
I mean, I always liked the indie spirit. I mean, cause indies would do cooler work. So I was always like interested in that. And I was less interested in the business side of things.
Less interested.
At the time, I just want to do cool work. Like, what do I care about? P&Ls and the funnel and stuff like that. But that was a conscious decision. I think I was attracted by whenever I went to a place where I was attracted by the work, it always ended up really in a good place for the most part. Like I really liked the work Droger did, so I really wanted to work there.
Yeah.
DDB, I was about, and it was experience. Pereira, same thing. Like I was kind of like, I liked some of the cooler stuff they did, but it wasn't any interesting culture work. Like stuff that felt very culturally relevant to me personally, my interests.
Yeah.
And I went inside the doors and I was like, oh, it's like a lot of just like, just really nice white people at the time. And there was, so there was nothing interesting about street culture or rap or hip hop or basketball.
Okay, right.
JL did a lot of that kind of stuff. And right. I walked in the rooms. I was like, okay, cool. Like the storytelling here is different.
Yep.
So yeah, it was always, I was attracted by the creative and the, what the work could be.
Okay.
And type of work.
So going from ECD at Fig and taking a step up to CCO to a place like McKinney, what's that been like?
I don't know what the fuck I'm doing.
No.
I'm sure you do.
No, it's been the coolest. It's been probably the most fulfilling and maddening and confusing experience of my career. And I wouldn't trade it for a single thing.
And you're a like, father of two.
Oh yeah, that's right. Well, I was father of one at the time I took the job.
Oh, damn.
No, yeah. but my wife was pregnant when I was interviewing. It's like jumping in the deep end, which I love. That's why I always love. I've always wanted to, even moving to Australia and stuff, I was always jumping in the deep end. Going to jail in New York was jumping to a deep end in some sort of way. I thrive in that.
Yeah.
When I don't know what I'm doing, I might need to figure it out because I get actually challenged and engaged and I ask a lot of questions and I like rely on people as opposed to when I'm doing things where I'm in my wheelhouse and I'm just kind of like, I go back to being a one man show and just reverting to some bad habits. It's a completely different job. There is no training. What got you to an ECD is no longer really as relevant when you become a CCO. Like, yes, the work obviously is important and being able to come up with great ideas, but like all of a sudden you need to learn how to manage and grow a department. You need to understand how every client works and how everyone's, you know, resourced and percentages and, you know, what are the ambitions for the year and what are the numbers you're trying to get to. And it just becomes a business, which I love. I love the business side of what we do ultimately, because it's the perfect symbiosis between right side of the brain and left side of the brain.
Yep. Do you think that's something that's developed over time though?
For you? Yeah. Be. Yeah, for sure. I don't think as a 20, I mean, some people probably do, but as a 25 year old creative, you're not like,
no,
really want to know what those KPIs are all about.
Why do you think that is though? Like, I mean, do you know, because if you understand deeper, you can get to better work in a way? Like,
yeah. And I think also you start to, because when you start out, you just think of cool work. Yes. You see the work. The longer you work in it, the deeper you get in the process and what makes it all tick.
Mm.
And then the better understanding of the system you have, the better you can game it or the better you can improve it, whatever that may be.
Yeah.
But you look at it and understand what it is you need to do in order to get to the work you want to create. And there's a giant methodology. My wife is a client, so I get to see and hear a lot of the meetings that she has. And you kind of understand how you're such an insignificant part of their like day to day. And more importantly, for the most part, like you're usually their best part of their week when you show up at a deck and ideas. And so understanding what their struggles they're going through and understanding what it is that the pressures they're facing and what they need to ultimately drive and have the work drive to allows you to be a better leader for the creatives and steer them in a way to do perhaps work that might not be super exciting at times and still try to reach those moments when you can, but why, and make them understand why you need to get to where they need to get to.
And how do you build that trust though?
With a client?
Yeah.
It's different for every person. I think it's...
apart from taking them to a basketball game. Or
that kind of schmoozing thing, that old school stuff. Honestly, I think it's just like, it's being a good listener. And I think the thing I'm still trying to figure out is, I've seen creative leaders be very hard-headed and be very difficult. And I've seen it both work to a certain extent and also be the downfall of the relationship, which is like, yeah, we did great work. That was great for quarter number four, but do I want to go through that again with them? Yeah. Probably not. So from a long, like, there's like a short-term pop of like doing cool creative work and it's like, but it usually seems to be very difficult. So I'm trying to understand how to best guide being a good partner and listening and being receptive to the feedback, but also finding ways to, at times, keep the work pure and keep the vision as close to what you think is best for the business as opposed to what they think is best on the business, because they're judging it based on information they get that you don't get,
yeah,
that might actually, you don't need to get in order to create great brand, you know, brand level type work.
Yeah.
But it comes with just like being in the trenches and working with them and going through rounds, and you need to find some success.
Yeah.
Like ultimately, like success drives trust.
Totally.
100%. So,
and actually, when it comes to the team around you helping build that trust as well, one question that I wanted to ask is like, what is the perfect leadership team in your opinion? And how does that all help build trust with the client? Because surely if you're questioning something that the client's saying, you've got, I don't know, your CSO or your chief client officer or whoever, or your CEO in the meeting. When is it working like clockwork, do you think?
It's a good question.
I think it's just
being surrounded by people who are smart. They have a little bit of ego, but not too much ego. They're smart. They understand the business, and I mean, strategists to me, I think creators are actually the dumbest people in the room, to be honest. When it comes to marketing, honestly, because we always just.
I don't think you're the only creator to have ever said that.
Yeah, I think we are the dumb. Like, clients will say stuff, and I'm just like, I understand it and I get it. But strategists will read between the lines and figure out what it is they're actually trying to get to without maybe not saying it totally. Account people say anything, they're able to decipher the matrix that clients put in front of us in order to better equip you as creatives. So I fundamentally believe in like surrounding myself with smarter people that can help you get to what the client is saying and create a environment where the client not only feels heard, but they're like, oh, they're not only getting it, but they're helping build it or massage. I don't need to keep holding their hands across the way.
Yeah.
So yeah, like our CSO McKinney, like Jasmine Dadlani, is like super fucking sharp. And I'll be like, I think this is what they're saying. I'm like in a panic or whatever. She's like, no, like this is what I got from it. And I was like, oh, okay, I see where you're getting that from. Let me double back on my information and think it through again.
Okay. Wow. Fair enough. Yeah, talk to me about McKinney. Like, what's the kind of, how is it going? You've been there not even a year.
No. And like 4 months.
Yeah, with 4 months with Matt Lee. And what's cool. The vision? Tell me all. Like, how do we?
It's really, really cool, man. I think it's, like I said, we're not an indie. Like, so it's a mid-size agency, but with a bit of an indie spirit. But, you know, we have, you know, 350, 400 people. We have dozens and dozens and dozens of millions of dollars in, you know, in billings. And we are a full service agency as part of a, you know, this kind of a smaller network in Chale. But we have our own production studio. We have our own influencer agency. We have our own design studio. We have all these different cross functionalities. In order to better serve a modern client's needs on a day-to-day basis across all levels of the funnel. And what I, you know, a lot of people ask me why McKinney is kind of like the main question I got a lot of times in interviews or chats or whatever. But I think after my experience at Fig, where I think inherently there was a lot of pitching and there's a lot of like pressures of the indie financial dollar, kind of bottom dollar situation, which I felt tarnished perhaps the way we would approach creative work some of the times. And that's totally understandable. Once again, it's not a dig, it just is what it is. McKinney had grown like 60, 70% during COVID at a time where most agencies struggled.
Wow.
You know, they'd grown from 100 to 300 in a year, 2 years. Like, it was exponential growth, which to me showed a really smart executive team led by Joe. And it really kind of demonstrated that there is a really strong understanding of how to grow a business and how to grow revenue. There's like some really nice pops. You know, Caesars is a great brand, and we do some great work for them. Sherwin is iconic chips work. There's a little bit of hits with Popeyes and so on. Like, there are these little moments, but it was kind of like this. And to me, really, the challenge was going to a place where the financials are pretty stable in this climate, getting me the security to be able to go in, okay, cool, like I can work with Lyle, the co-CCO, and like, how do we modernize the creative offering? How do we push the creative work? How do we work with the talent inside the agency and give them perhaps a different way of approaching things that had been missing. And that was a mandate from Joe, was like, you and Lyle help work, you know, work with the exec team, work with this fantastic level of talent, like help modernize and help us grow and help us push a creative offering. And that takes time, of course.
Yeah.
But we're just, you know, every day, the decks are better, which is the decks are better. Ideas are better. The conversations are stronger. We've evolved our agency branding. We've changed the way we show up in meetings. We built a creative vision, which is called Refuse to Be Ignored, which is really about, our motto is to create unfair attention for our brands
and
clients. And I love that. And so Refuse to Be Ignored is just the way our creative, you know, internal rallying cry, which is, clients can't afford to be ignored in today's day and age, nor can we, nor can our ideas, nor the way we show up, like, and really building a sense of pride of like, we spend so many hours concepting and thinking of ideas that I want everyone to be proud of the work that they go in with every time. So just all of that has been, you know, it's been a slow process as anything, but it's been really, really great. And I think, you know, last year was a year of evolution, of figuring things out. I think this year we're going to see a progression in both the creative work and our growth as a business.
Yeah, great.
And then after that, you know, I think we're going to do hopefully some real iconic piece of work and just keep pushing that.
That's awesome.
But yeah.
And in terms of
5-year plan.
No, I love that. That's wicked. And in terms of, let's talk about the team and growing a team and the ideal team. Cause I know you have some great opinions on diverse storytelling and things like that.
Opinions, my friend.
I love it. No. So big part of that will be growing your team or at least, you know, hiring different shaped humans in different areas. But what do you think is the ideal makeup of a creative department?
I'm still figuring that out. I'll be honest. I think,
fair.
I mean, both Lyle and I are still figuring that out. I think it's hard. Me especially, but there is a propensity when you start a new place, especially as a CCO, but same thing as a CMO, it's really is like, I'm going to blow everything up and like bring in my people. And that's kind of some of the advice I was given by some other CCOs, were like, you got to go in, you got to really make some drastic cuts and then bring in the people that you trust and thing. And I didn't want to do that. Mm. I think it's kind of bullshit. I'm a pure, you know, like example of like somebody that has faltered in some environments because of the creative leadership, and has also really succeeded and blossomed under different creative leadership.
Yeah.
So, I mean, of course, there's always turnover. That's only naturally part of the game, and there's fluctuation, stuff like that. But inherently, what we really set out to do is like set the vision, go in. We're very involved in the work. We're in a lot of meetings. We're in the decks. Like keep. Like push, lead by example, allow people to see what you want to create or what the vision is you want, and allow them to rise to it or respond to it and find ways to kind of create their version of it. And then after some time, they can identify like, okay, well, like some people are stars, some people are hard workers, some people are, you know, good for the business. Yeah. Like everyone has a clear role. Not everyone's going to be a fucking, Dave Droga type, you know, acolyte of advertising knowledge and success. But like, so in terms of the makeup of a creative department, I honestly think like my biggest thing is people that care, that like fundamentally care and aren't happy to settle for just checking off boxes.
Yeah.
And then from there, it just becomes kind of like taste levels, essentially. Like different people have different taste levels and push things differently to different worlds. Like it's a creative endeavor. But I think having people that really, really care, that understand the business and that can think outside the brief and really kind of think about how they can impact a business and how they can impact a client and how they can impact a team, I think is really important. But yeah, it's tough. It's hard to really figure out, because you can hire a bunch of guns, but half of them probably just have like me, giant egos and are hard to work with, and they're just not a fun.
Yeah,
like I don't want to be in a room with y'all that much. Like,
you don't want that.
But then you have people that don't care. And then you're like, you know, working at 2 a.m. fixing copy. And you're like, this isn't what I can't be this deep in the weeds. So I don't know. It's all very hard. But I think, yeah, just look for people that can think of really interesting ideas that give a shit.
Yeah, yeah. No, totally. And what about the kind of the diverse storytelling element of a team and the makeup?
Yeah, so like obviously like as a product of diversity, and let's be honest, like it's a pretty white business, right? Mm-hmm. We can call it what it is. Like it's, if you look at all the C-suites and the execs and all the levels, like it's a lot of white people. So of course diversity is really important, but then diversity has become this kind of catchphrase and statistic, and agencies, including our own, can at times be like, we have this percentage of this type of diversity. And honestly, I don't give a shit. Not because I don't care about diversity, obviously I do, but I don't believe in diversity for the sake of creating kind of like a more even playing ground. I think ultimately the reason why I care about diversity is to create diverse storytelling. And by which I mean, like, when you come from a diverse background, for most part, when you come from when you've had to acclimate, when you're an immigrant, when you come from a rough upbringing, whatever that may be, you're different from the rest of your school, whatever that kind of like story of differentiation is, results in you being a more interesting storyteller, as opposed to a lot of people who've had relatively homogenous lives, which there's nothing wrong with that once again. But I think diversity is like, it's like people who have gone through had to get out out the mud, like, or struggled, who've moved around. Like, I've moved so many times in my life. Like, I don't know a single fucking person from before the age of 12.
Really?
Not a single person. Couldn't name you a single, never couldn't contact them. Like, so the first 12 years of my life, it's literally just—
Where
like,
were you for the first 12 years of your life?
Well, I was born in France. I grew up in Tripoli. Then I moved back to France and back to Tripoli, then Canada when I was 12.
Wow.
And like my high school, even like my 2 years in Canada, I know, but my high school friends from grade 9 are like still my boys to this day. But yeah, I couldn't tell you a single thing. So I was constantly moving every couple of years, different countries, different cultures, different languages, like, which has resulted in me being able to be a bit of a chameleon and talk aimlessly at people to find myself interesting. But it is the ability to because we are by nature, like the way we come up with ideas is based on our own personal experiences and our own observations.
Yeah.
If you come from a diverse background, like your observations for the most part have a different level of depth, are probably a little more profound, are probably a little more understanding. You're more open to the different ways of thinking and different consumers and different likes and dislikes. And it allows you, I think, to be more receptive.
Yeah.
To that. So that's why I think there's such value in diverse storytellers. Like, that's what I want, hopefully, in the creative department.
How do you find them if the work isn't necessarily
up? You just talk to them.
What questions would you ask? I'm just very curious.
Are you a diverse storyteller?
No. Yeah, is that what you're doing? <That'll-
laughs> That's the only question. I think you just ask people about their lives and what their interests are and like what their personal beliefs and, you know, not their morals and ethics necessarily, but you just get a sense. We just hired this art director called Braden Clark he's in New York, he's going to LA for LA office, but you know, his book is just had this like really interesting mix of just different kind of, you know, colors and designs and ideas. But he was also, you know, he worked with Janelle Monáe's team as like a creative for her. His background is, I think he's from Hawaii. He's just like amazing, kind of like a vibe, his whole energy. But like, long story short, like just talking to him, you got a sense that like this person has like a story to tell and he has a voice that he's developed.
Yeah.
You know, we hired these two kids out of BYU recently. Same thing, like very different upbringing. BYU's a Mormon school in itself, so it's interesting. Different backgrounds, different likes, and you just get a sense of who they are and what they care about. And it's just through questioning. And it's an energy thing.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
Cool. Let's talk about, I want to go on to brands now and trends and
sure.
Brands work that you think is interesting and advertising at the moment? Like, where are you spotting anything that brands are asking for when you're taking briefs? Like, are there any consistencies that you're seeing when you're getting briefed?
Yeah, I mean, I think obviously, like, there's the bigger things, obviously, is understanding how to show up in social, but also how to play within culture.
Okay.
And what that means for them.
As in, like, how does their brand sit?
Yeah, how do we get close? How do we work within culture? How do we show up in culture in ways that feels interesting? How are we kind of, like, creating conversation around our brand? How are we making ourselves feel relevant to both, a lot of times, to a younger audience while staying true and close to our older audience?
Mm-hmm.
'Cause a lot of brands, obviously, you know, the 35 to 44 is kind of like where they're getting a lot of their money from, but they also need to age the brand down. It's kind of a bigger thing that a lot of people talk about.
What's that? So the aged brand down?
Like, how do you find a way to get in the conversation, the zeitgeist, and feel relevant and relatable to Gen Z and so on? Especially in this creator economy, and as the creative economy, I think slowly evolves into creator brands that over time are going to like take over. How do we keep our foothold and avoid ourselves becoming relevant?
Mm.
So I think, but also at the same time, how do we keep driving sales and revenue, especially because we have QSR clients, you know, in this time of like economic uncertainty, tariffs, you know, operational costs going up.
Yep.
Consumers having much more diversity of choice. So perhaps they're not as affiliated with your brand or as loyal to your brand. So I don't think there's any consistencies necessarily, as there is like a constant craving to be relevant and evolve the brand while still ensuring that they drive revenue, which has always been the complicated matter at hand. Fair. Since the beginning of.
Is there anything that you think brands should be aware of when they're considering doing more culturally relevant work?
Yeah, don't hold a fucking mirror up to culture.
What does that mean?
Like, a lot of brands
don't hold a mirror up to culture.
But I think it's just a lot of times they're like, they see something like, I want to jump on that. Or, this person's hot, so let's work with them. And it's like, but like.
So jumping on trends. And
You're just holding up a mirror to culture, and it just feels, for lack of a better word, like predatory, as opposed to being additive to culture. Like finding something that you think is interesting within the zeitgeist and either iterating on it, evolving it, or presenting it in a different dimension that the fans of that trend or the fans of that piece of culture respect you for joining in the conversation, because nobody wants a brand. The first thing culture gatekeeps is from consumerism. You don't want brands to come into your piece of culture, right? That's when it loses the purity, because you didn't get into it because of the brand. So if you're gonna sit at the table, you best know how to both respect it and where it comes from, but like, how are you going to say something where they go, oh shit, yeah, you know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, you get it. Like, welcome.
Are there any brands that are standouts to you that are doing it quite well? Or have done?
Brands have done it really well that play well. I mean, McDonald's is probably the best example of it. I'm actually always kind of amazed that they did a partnership with Cactus Fleet, CFE. And I was like, really? Like, is that going to hit? And it absolutely hit. And then, but then they find a way to do BTS and it hits. And they find a way to do anime and it hits. Because, I mean, a lot of it is, they're not just like holding a reflection on like, we just did a collaboration with XYZ. Like, there is, they build an entire ecosystem around Cactus Jack and Travis Scott and Famous Meals, and it becomes something. They build an entire ecosystem around Kerwin Frost and the Adult Happy Meal. And so people are like, oh, that's cool. It's different. Yeah, it's Kerwin. Yeah, it's Adult Happy Meals. But it feels unique and different, so I'm into it. Like Grimace, I think Grimace was a little bit of like, they got lucky in the sense of like the culture just picked up on it and they jumped on it.
Okay.
But because it was so deep in the weird culture zeitgeist that it felt fun. And they didn't make it overly branded. Even with like the Kai Cenat Phantom chicken sandwich thing. Like it it's just ways to, they're like, they did a, it was basically a giant ad. It was like a one, you know, with the band and stuff. It was like a 30 minute streaming ad about the chicken sandwich and Phantom Tax. But it felt additive. It felt new. It wasn't like him just reading something to camera. It actually felt like an experience. Mm. So because of that, and it was respectful to the platform and respectful to the creator's language, it kept the sanctity of it. And therefore, it felt culturally additive as opposed to reflective.
Wow. That makes a lot of sense. I'm curious about who's not done it well and if there are any standouts. I don't want to I'm not going to throw you under the bus, but surely you've got one, or there must be a couple that you're like, what?
It happens a lot. But I don't really have time in my head, and also probably like I'm going to save something and then someone's going to hit me up like, I worked on that. I hate the Super Bowl trend. It's nothing to do with culture necessarily, but I guess nostalgia is part of culture values. Like we brought back this franchise. Like, it's like, we took the Harry Met Sally scene, we brought it back. Or like, I mean, people like Groundhog Day. I guess I'm very different. Like, we, Fast and Furious, they're back, but now they're slow. And like, I get it. It's when you write it in a deck and you put it there, you're like, cool. Like, I get it. And it sounds fun. Personally, for me, I'm always like, I didn't ask for this. And I don't think the people in that are like huge Fast and Furious fans are like, yes. Yeah. Like, you feel like it. Like, I'm a big Fast and Furious fan. So I feel like I feel like it's sellout to me. This is no disrespect to the agency that did it. Like, you guys do great work. I know you're at age and everything. So like, keep doing your thing. And it probably does really well. It's going to have lots of results. So like, but personally, as a Fast and Furious fan, I wasn't dying to see them like, brought back. It just makes them feel, it's making me feel sad about them. Like, it ruins like my love. Like, when Harry Met Sally, when they're back, I'm like, it's about Mayo. And it's funny, I get it. It's just, for whatever reason, as somebody who loves that movie, it kind of ruins it for me. I don't know why. It's just how I feel. But once again, we work, and this is why I want to be very clear, we work in a very subjective field.
Yeah, totally, dude.
So like, 100%. Everyone's allowed to have their opinions. Like, and I want to preface everything I say is, even if I don't like it, I'm sure lots of other people like it. And the people that came up with it are probably very smart and brilliant. And the clients that bought it are brave and smart, and they know what they're doing, and I'm sure it'll have results on it. It is purely one subjective opinion.
100%. No, totally. That's the disclaimer that you want.
Well, yeah, I just don't want to be, I'm not like hating on it. It's just my own preference thing. When I see ideas like that in a deck, I'm like, oh.
Okay.
But that's my own thing.
And we've got the Super Bowl coming up, so, you know, plenty of ads to go around, and there'll be loads of judgment on LinkedIn, I suspect, or in the industry.
There already is. Like, so, yeah. I mean, yeah. Like, we did an ad. We have an ad out for Little Caesars with Eugene Levy's eyebrows fly off.
I've seen it.
It's classic, funny Caesar stuff. And then Pringles, and shout out John O'Flannery and Kevin Watkins, but John O'Flannery's like one of my best mates. They did an ad where the mustache flew off. So like, you know, it's a craziest coincidence, right? Like, how are you supposed to know? But they're both come from the same, you know, Super Bowl formula of like finding something that feels visually iconic and simple and entertaining.
Yeah.
And put it on the world, right? But like, I was like on LinkedIn and some random person had written this post, and he's like, you know, like, it's something about like how like there's no more originality. Look at these guys. They come with the same idea, and they have to cut like images next to each other. And he said, I won't even link you the spots because they're cringe. And I was like, brother, like, your energy is cringe. Like, if people that go on LinkedIn to talk shit about other people's work is so weird. And like, having it, like, I'm always like, I can't, like I said, like, I might not like something. It's fine. But I'm not going to go out and put it on blast on like a platform because I think it's odd.
Yeah.
And it's hypocritical because I just said something before that. But like, I was giving him a giant preface. But I think what I always try to keep an eye with Super Bowl as well is like, it's so much hard work to come up with an idea. So many chefs in the kitchen, so many nervous clients, rightfully so. it involves an incredible amount of patience and creative and bravery. And like, so every time I see a Super Bowl ad, I'm like, did I like it? I don't like it. That's my own personal taste. But do I respect the swing? Do I recognize the amount of fucking work that went into it? Absolutely. I didn't like, you know, there's a lot of just like top five Super Bowl spots.
It's so subjective. It's hard to even judge, isn't it? I mean, yeah.
It was the only time of the year, I think Lyle said this, but it's the only time of the year where the world is interested in what we do. They're like people are fundamentally interested in what we do as a business and a craft. And I think it's a great reflection and a great demonstration of like, there is, when you take a big swing and you do something really interesting, like people really, you know, interact with it. But if you took like if you did some sort of like AI amalgamation or recap of like people's opinions on LinkedIn on Super Bowl, like all the advertising professionals, it'd be such a bad look.
Yeah.
But when you look at all the work that people put up and we put on the world, I think for the most part, it's a good look. Anyways.
Have you got a favorite? Because I've always admired, is it the Coinbase one where it's kind of...
The QR code? Which is kind of like I think there's another...
So ridiculous.
Something was done similarly before.
Was that Droga? Was it?
No. That was...
I can't remember who it was.
Coinbase and I think it was Accenture. Yeah, Droga, Accenture, whatever you call it. My favorite Super Bowl commercial, is that going to ask me?
Yeah.
I love... Like I said, like I'm not a comedy guy by nature. I like big entertaining stuff, but and I really do respect the swings that people do to not do traditional ads for Super Bowl, like the case in the Mondays and stuff like that, like Coinbase stuff. I think these are really innovative and really smart, and I respect it. But for the regular Joe X sitting on a couch drinking a ton of beer, like they just want to see something to laugh at and remember. Yeah. Or in my opinion, when you do something that moves them, and I think Born of Fire, like the Chrysler imported from Detroit work, it's like 2 minutes, the one with Eminem in it.
Yeah.
Like it's so good. Like it's still, I just watched it recently. I'm like, it's so, so damn good because it's so topical. It came at a time where like the automotive industry was basically dead or dying. And it captured this like incredible comeback story, which America obviously loves and really prides itself on. This idea of like hard work and rolling up your sleeves and the idea of a comeback story, which this country is built on, but done in a way that's just tasteful and simple and raw. And I know we like to like shit on manifestos in the industry and rightfully so, because we open every deck with a manifesto, but when they're done well, it could be a reminder of how powerful they can be. And like, what other spot can you really credit for changing the perception, radically changing the perception of not only a city but a car brand and an entire like category? And it's 2 minutes long, which is like absurd. So I always look at that one.
Yeah, fair.
I think that's really great.
Fair enough. Cool. Is there anything that I just mean, we've got about 5 minutes left to kind
of... Damn.
Yeah, I know. Talking for 50 minutes.
I do that.
Is there anything you want to cover about team build, like McKinney? Is there anything that you...
McKinney's is the best agency in the world. You were killing it. Come through.
How do they get your attention at Mead?
Yeah.
How does a creative...
No, honestly, if any creative was really interested in what we do, in working for an agency that is really run by people who are nice, that we put a care, but also ambitious and want to do really interesting work, but also understand how to drive a business and how this marketing thing works. We're here. And we have offices across the US and we're growing. And my main prerogative really for most creatives, honestly, is like, I've had such a blessed career to do such great work and meet like celebrities and shoots and stuff. Like I want that same experience for all the creatives.
Yeah.
Cause this job is so hard. Like otherwise we could have gotten lawyers and doctors and stuff. Like it's not an easy job. It's not a 9-to-5. It's so like personal, the way we put our work on a piece of paper and present it and hope that people like it. Like, it's tough. So I really want people to be in an environment where they feel they can do that in a kind of a safe, but also like fun environment. But yeah, so come through. And then the other thing I was going to say, we need more ad nerds. That was the last thing I'll say.
Ad nerds.
Absolutely. We need more ad nerds.
We need more ad nerds.
We need more ad nerds.
Where are the annuals at, man?
It's just like, it's true. It's like, I feel like there's been a lot. I get it. Why? Because like, it's like, we're just kind of, you know, asking for creatives to think of crazy ideas and we're hiring from all different parts of the world and stuff like that. But like, finding ad nerds is a hard thing to come by. Like, people just know like annuals and like, be like, can name credits. And
yeah,
the amount of times I've had interviews or like Miami ad school where I've been like, who knows Craig Allen and Eric Coleman? And they'd be like, who the fuck is that? And you're like, come on, guys. Like people that have like Jerry Graff, like people that have fundamentally changed the trajectory of our business. It's like being a director and not watching movies, or being a musician, not listening to fucking, you know, a rock musician, not listening to Zeppelin records. Like,
yeah, Jesus Christ.
So for all those young kids, be more of an ad nerd. It's going to help you in the long run. And then I think, last but not least, I always say this, but for anyone who is, having a hard time breaking in, who might not look like everybody else in this industry, like, hit me up on LinkedIn. I'll try to find some time and we can chop it up. Because I know what it feels like to be very different from everyone else, or being one of a kind, or coming from a very different background, and trying to figure out how to make it and how to be heard and get your voice out. So
I think that's a lovely way to end. Thank you.
Oh, wait, sorry. Can I finish one more thing?
Yeah, go for it.
Last thing I was going to say, but like, this is all about me, which is nauseating to say the least. But honestly, I think what you guys do, like the way you guys are approaching recruiting and the way you post stuff and the way you communicate on LinkedIn and stuff like that, I think it's such a breath of fresh air. Like, oh, it's thanks, such man. A fucking breath of fresh air. And I think you guys, like, speaking of Adners, like, you guys really care and you understand what the business is about, but you also have one eye towards the future and you really do want to create better impact, better teams, better environments for people. And I really hope you guys keep doing what you're doing, and I hope that we get to work together more. But yeah, thank you.
I appreciate that. Thank you so much.
No worries.
Lovely way to end.